Hi, everybody. My name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. The taper and the signer get the biggest applause of anybody here. I'm glad to be here, glad to be sober, and would like to thank you for inviting me to do this. It's an honor to be asked. I'm always still sort of surprised when somebody calls and asks me to do anything, really. I mean, if people weren't inviting me anywhere at the end of my drinking, they were avoiding my calls. The few who I still called were avoiding my calls. And so there's always this sort of little thrill that somebody's calling to ask me to do something. Actually, the nicest part about doing this, there's two really nice parts about it. Well, three. The first is when you get the call and, you know, they're asking you. And the second is, you know, you get to come to these things and you hear a lot of other good speakers and you meet nice people. And the third is at the very end when you're applauding. The actual doing of it is, you know, kind of the downside, but I guess that's the price you have to pay. I believe I was born an alcoholic, but that doesn't really matter whether you think that you were or not, or, you know, it's just what I believe. By the way, I should tell you that I'm not, if you're new, I'm not any kind of an expert on anything here. So anything I tell you is really my opinion based on the 23 and a half years that I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm right in most of my opinions, but I'm obliged to tell you that they are just my opinions. No, I'm right for me, and I might be right for you, too. But if you don't like anything I say, you know, take what you can, as we say, take what you can and file the rest for future reference. Go to another meeting tomorrow. You'll surely hear some other opinions there. And so, anyway, so the reason I say that I think I was born an alcoholic is that I've always felt different. I've never felt like I fit in. I never was able to talk to people. I didn't have any of the skills for living that most of you seem to have. Well, not most of you, but most of the people out there seem to have. And the first time I picked up a drink, it did that magic thing for me that I assume it did for you if you're sitting here this morning, and that is it made me feel completely different. The first time I drank was when I was 13. I was at a party with other 13-year-olds, and they were drinking rum and Coke, so I drank rum and Coke. I don't remember having any feelings about should I drink, should I not drink. There was no debate. They were drinking. I drank. I just wanted to fit in. And so I drank that rum and Coke and maybe another one. I don't really remember how much I drank that night, probably not that much. I think when you're 13 and you've never drank before, it doesn't take much. But however much it took, I drank that much and then some, which is how I always drank. And the magic, as I say, happened for me. I really relaxed. I really felt great. I could talk to people at that party. I danced and felt like I was the best dancer on the floor. It was great. Now, also that night, I blacked out and passed out and woke up the next morning in bed with a Marine that I didn't know, which was a little more than I had meant to do. I was a nice girl from Newport Beach, and nobody in my crowd was behaving like this. And so I felt guilty and ashamed, and I was scared that I was going to get pregnant. I mean, you know, whatever bad feelings you might imagine would accompany such an event, I had those bad feelings. And yet, I drank again at the very next possible opportunity without a thought. Without a thought, the next opportunity that there was to drink, I just put my hand out and took it and drank. I was apparently willing to pay whatever price there was to pay for drinking from the gate because I didn't like the way I behaved. I never wanted to be that kind of a girl and eventually woman. I had always meant to be a person that people would admire and respect. Up until the time I started drinking, I was a straight-A student in school, and I went to church on Sundays, and I was real involved in a church youth group, and I did those things because they were important to me. That's the kind of person I wanted to be. Within 6 months after that first drunk, I was getting C's and D's in school. I'd quit going to church, dropped out of that youth group, had a whole new set of friends. My life had changed completely. I didn't notice that it had happened. My parents noticed, and they were upset, and they sent me away to boarding school for my last couple of years of high school, which I guess had the desired effect in that it was a very structured environment, and it was very difficult to get alcohol there. So I think alcoholics, when they're applying themselves, whether it be work or school or whatever, when they're actually, you know, trying, try harder than anybody else, work harder than anybody else. And so I did, since there was not the distraction of drinking, I did study hard, and I graduated from high school. But you know, I'm an alcoholic. I got married the year after I got out of high school. The reason I got married is this guy asked. I'd like to give you a deeper reason, but he wasn't actually even the one that I liked the best, but he's the one that asked. I think I was 17 years old when he asked me to marry him. I was, I guess, 18 and a half when we got married. I was 17 when he asked me. Now, that's not over the hill, you know. But I remember feeling this sort of tremendous sense of relief that I wasn't going to have to worry about that anymore. Had not been aware that I had been worrying about it. And, in fact, I had plenty of, well, when you behave the way I was behaving, you'll have plenty of boyfriends. So I had my share of boyfriends. So it was a complete lack of self-worth. I didn't know that. Any insight that I have into who I was, believe me, I didn't have it at the time. Any insight that I might have or that you might hear in my story, I got long after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that I was going to get that insight when I took my inventory. That is not the case for me, and I don't think that that is what the inventory is designed to do. That's a moral inventory. It's designed to essentially tell those dirty little secrets you've been walking around with your whole life. It's not a psychological exercise designed to get you in touch with your feelings. When I started to have insight into who I am and how I've lived my life is when I started sponsoring other women in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I started seeing myself and hearing myself in them. Anyway, so now I'm 18, I'm married, and I have absolutely nothing in common with this boy at all. I mean, he's a nice boy, but I don't love him. I knew the day walking down the aisle I didn't love him. I remember thinking as I was walking down the aisle on my dad's arm, this is a big mistake. But I liked him. And a lot of my life has been like I was an actress on a stage and I'm up here watching me do all this. And so I just sort of watched me walk down the aisle and get married. And we were married for 6 months only. I actually believe we would have been married a lot longer because I'm not the kind of person who likes confrontation much. I can't imagine that I ever would have gone home to him and said something like, gee, you know what, dear, I've never really loved you and I'm out of here. I mean, it's inconceivable that I ever could have done that. But other things occurred in that period of time that we were married that sort of enabled me to leave out the back door, which if there's a back door to leave by, that's what I will always pick. We'd been married a few months, and my only brother, there was my brother and I growing up, and my brother was killed in an accident in the Navy, and I adored my brother. He was, like my hero, and his ship was in Japan, and this accident occurred, and he was very badly injured, and he was in the hospital in Japan, and the Navy Department, or whoever does this sort of thing, was sending telegrams every day to my mother, telling her his condition and how he was doing, and he was obviously very gravely injured, and so we were very concerned and worried, and I was writing to him every day and sending him cards and stuff like that, and then we got this telegram one day that said he was enough improved that they were going to be sending him back to the States, that he would have this long, long recovery ahead of him, but he was healthy enough that they were going to be able to let him travel and ship him back to the States. And we were all very excited because that meant we would get to spend time with him and see him, and so we're very happy about that. And then the next day we got a telegram that he had died. Now, shortly before he died, I had sent this card to him, one of these studio cards that is supposed to be funny, I guess. On the front it said something to the effect of, heard you were ailing but not to worry. And then you open it up, and on the inside it said, only the good die young. It seemed like a really funny card when I bought it, but then he died. And I felt really bad. I felt so insane. I couldn't believe that I had done such an insensitive thing. I love my brother. I would never have intentionally done anything that might have hurt him. I felt awful. I remember during the period of time, I think it was a couple of weeks from the time that he died until his belongings were shipped back to my mother, thinking the timing was such that maybe that card didn't get there. Maybe that card arrived after he died, and I prayed every day, please, God, let that card still be in the mail somewhere. His trunk came back, and my mother opened it, and that card was laying there on the top, and it had been opened. And when my mother turned away, I took that card, I went in the bathroom, I stood there and tore it up in little tiny pieces and flushed it down the toilet. I remember standing in there crying and feeling so terrible, so awful that I'd done this. Of course I didn't do this on purpose. I know this today, but I simply couldn't see it. I just felt terrible. I never told anybody about that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 30 years old. I was incapable of telling anybody about that and how terrible I felt. And that is how I lived my life. I was filled with secrets and things that I could not talk to anybody about, shame and guilt and all kinds of awful things that some were really terrible and some, like this, were really not terrible at all. I mean, I certainly had, not done anything intentional there, but And had I been able to talk to somebody about it, I probably could have figured that out. But I couldn't. I simply was incapable. And so I drank. My poor little, now I'm crying all the time because I feel so guilty. My brother died and I have this terrible guilt and I'm crying all the time. And my poor little husband had no idea what to do to help me. I mean, we were so ill-equipped to deal with life. And he said to me one day, I don't know how to help you. Maybe you should go stay with your mother for a while. Maybe she could help you get there. And he was well-intentioned. I mean, he loved me. He wanted us to be together. And so I said, okay. And I went back to my mother's and I never went back. See, that's the back door, like I told you. I didn't have to look at him and say, hey, out of here. You know, I just didn't go back. He called and tried to put this back together and, you know, suggested marriage counseling or whatever. And I would not even talk to him. I would have no part of it. Now, clearly this is somebody to whom I owe amends, you know. When I was sober about, I don't know, 5 or 6 months, maybe six or seven months, I ran into him. I didn't see him in all those years. From the time I was 18 until I was 30 and got sober, and I ran into him somewhere in my first year of sobriety, and I thought, God, this is incredible. You know, here I am, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and God just puts this guy right back here in my path. I get to make amends. This is really great. And then my very next thought was, well, no, I'm not sober all that long, and I'm not actually to that step yet. And so you laugh now, but let me tell you, I'm 23 years sober, and I haven't seen him from that day to this. So I like to mention that when I talk because it is my hearty recommendation that if these opportunities to make amends present themselves to you, that you take advantage of them. You know, that's one I should have had crossed off my list years ago, and it's still on there. So anyway, I left him, and I moved up to L.A., which is about 50 miles away, and I got a job at an apartment, and I became a daily drunk. I was, I guess, 19 years old, and I had ID that said, I don't know, that I was 35 or something, And I started drinking every day. My first job was at a trucking company, and I started drinking in these. I was working as a secretary, and I started drinking in these bars where these truck drivers drank. And you know, I've drank over the years in really nice places and in really awful places. I think I like those truck driver bars the best. Often I was the only woman in one, which is obviously why I like that a lot. I got a lot of attention. I felt really important. I felt like I felt really loved. The truth of the matter is I was loved often. I always convinced myself that I was in love every time. I never thought of myself as being promiscuous, but most certainly I was. But I just didn't, I did not see it that way at all. I really didn't. Sometimes, though, I'd have these little moments of clarity, as I've come to call them since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, that were a little painful to experience. I remember the reason I left that trucking company, I had been working there for, I don't know, 10 months maybe, and I was sitting at my desk one day, which was like here, and to the right of my desk was a picture window that looked out onto the loading dock where these truck drivers would load their trucks, and so I could see four or five of these truck drivers standing out there on that dock. I couldn't hear them because this glass was there, but I could see them. They were not any further away than these people here, and they were standing there looking at me and talking and laughing. I had known every one of them in the biblical sense, you might say, and it was humiliating. You know, it was really humiliating. I remember I sat at my desk and I turned and, you know, tried to pretend that I hadn't seen them and tried not to cry sitting there. I was so humiliated. My answer to that is that I quit my job, you know, and I went to the next job and I behaved exactly the same way there. When I drink, there's just men involved. It's what I do, you know. Wherever I worked, that was my life. It was my whole life. If I'm working at this company, you six people in the front row are my life. I work with you. I eat all my meals with you. I drink with you. I sleep with you and or your spouses. I care not. Eventually, it is so awful here that I cannot face you in the light of day, and I leave, and it's like you're all dead. I never see you or speak to you again, and now you're my new family over here at the new job. And that is how I lived. Here's the kind of drunk I am. I went out with my boss and some coworkers one night after work, and everybody was drunk. We were bar hopping around downtown L.A., and we were all drunk. I was not the only one drunk that night, but I was evidently drunker than the rest of them because when we wound up in the strip joint, I was the only one who auditioned for a job. Seemed like a real good idea at the time. I remember getting up from there were about 10 of us at this round table, and the stage was here, and we were right at this front table here, and I had excused myself from the table to go find the ladies' room, which was sort of down the hall behind the stage, and I have just very vague memories of this, but I remember bumping into the owner or the manager or whatever of the bar, and I was making derogatory remarks about the caliber of his dancers, and you know how this kind of thing goes, and, you know, well, if you think you're such hot stuff, you know. And so the next thing my coworkers and boss know, and now just a moment ago I've excused myself from the table and I'm dressed kind of like this, you know, and now I come back and I'm practically naked and I'm dancing in front of my, I can still see, like it was yesterday, the look on my boss's face. So, this began what I like to think of as my show business career. Another thing about me is that I've always been sort of greedy about money, and I saw this as an opportunity to get rich. I actually made a ton of money doing this. I have no idea where it went. I guess I drank it all. I don't know. But I started living this actually sort of a double life. I would go to work in the daytime at my secretarial job, and then I'd get off at 5. And I was, you know, I'm a good worker, and I'm quiet during the day. I'm not drinking, and plus now I'm tired because I'm not getting much sleep either. But so I just go to work in the day and I do my job and not bother anybody much, you know. And they all just thought I was kind of a quiet little thing. And then I'd get off and go to work at Nick's or Joe's or whatever fine establishment I was working at, and take off most of my clothes and go to work. And I would have to drink to do this. I'm shy and self-obsessed, and there's no way that I can do this kind of work Cold Stone sober, or like that I would even want to do it sober. And so I would get down to the bar, and as I was getting into my costume, I would have a few drinks, and you know, I don't ever remember undershooting the mark to where I wasn't, if I wasn't drunk enough or didn't feel, you know, whatever it is I needed to feel, I just simply did not come out of the dressing room until I was there. But I often overshot the mark. I'm an alcoholic. I cannot control and enjoy my drinking, and so it is literally impossible for me to work from like 7 in the evening till 2 in the morning as a dancer and maintain the right amount of alcohol in my system at all times. I mean, it's impossible. Occasionally it happened, but I would guess more than 30 times probably. I just passed out on stage, just crashed to the ground. And the kinds of bars that I worked in, it didn't matter much. I remember at Nick's in particular, they had a couple of guys from the audience would just, it was, you know, sort of a regular occurrence, they would just get up and pick me up and carry me into this little back room where they had a sofa, apparently for this very reason. And they would put me on this sofa and close the door and come back out, and then I would sleep it off there. And if I came to, I can just remember this like it happened 10 minutes ago. If I came to, and then before the bar closed, you know, and the night was still going on, I would be really hot and stuffy in that little room, and I could hear the, just sort of feel the pounding of the music out there and just feel that excitement and that splash cold water on my face and, gosh, just come back out. And it seemed to me, as I came back out on stage, it was to thunderous applause from these fans. And I felt, I'm telling you, that no movie star in the world could have felt more adoration or love from her fans than I felt there in Nick's, coming out of being passed out. To say that I was not in touch with reality would be to sum it up pretty well, I think. I met the guy that was to become my second husband there at Nick's. He was, my parents were not happy. Let me sum this up by saying that we were married for 11 years and my parents never met him. They felt so strongly about it. We lived together a while and eventually did get married. And you know, I've often wondered why I married. I did grow to love him in the end, but I certainly didn't love him when I married him. I think the reason I married him is that alcohol was starting, I would not have been able to tell you this at the time, but that alcohol was starting not to work for me. It was getting really scary, and I think I saw some sort of protection there, that I would be somehow safe, that he would take care of me. I still had a good number of years of drinking left, but it didn't do that magic like it used to, you know? Or sometimes it did, but it'd be like here and gone, and I kept drinking and drinking and drinking, trying to recapture that feeling, not knowing that once it goes, it's kind of, you know, it's really on its way out. So now I'm married, but I'm behaving like I'm still single. And so it was causing a lot of problems. We had a lot of fights. He drank. I wouldn't have married him, or I probably wouldn't have even met him if he didn't drink. But now that we're married, my drinking, and it wasn't even so much my drinking, it was my behavior whilst drinking that became this big topic around the house and of conversation. And things got really uncomfortable. I didn't, you know, I never meant to be this kind of a woman. I was cheating on him all the time, and I never meant to be like that. But it's like my life was completely out of control. I started going to jail. shortly after we got married, and I couldn't believe this. I remember the first time I got arrested thinking, I'm a nice girl from Newport Beach. This can't be happening to me. Well, the truth of the matter is I hadn't been a nice girl in years and years and years, you know. But I just didn't see it. I just couldn't see it. My second arrest was in Tijuana for obscene dancing. You sort of get the picture here, you know. Things were not going well. I started drinking at home shortly thereafter. I remember thinking, you know, after I started drinking at home, that I had this drinking problem under control now. I remember thinking that one day. I don't know what would have possessed me to think such a thing, because I was drinking until I got drunk every single day, passing out every single night, sometimes doing really inappropriate things on my lunch hour at work, and, you know, then going to work or not going back to work, or, you know, really my life was a mess. And yet I thought, I have this drinking problem under control. I guess I thought that because I wasn't getting arrested. I wasn't waking up with strange people. You know, when you drink in a rocking chair in your living room in a purple flannel bathrobe, nothing much happens. I turned into one of those pathetic people who play sad records over and over again. I liked Ray Charles' Born to Lose. That was just oh, God. I'd play it and cry and play it and cry and feel so sorry for myself. And often as not, I'd get the idea to call somebody on the phone. The notions to call old friends and such never came at, you know, like 7:30 in the evening. So always occurred at 2 or 3 in the morning, and it was always somebody really, truly appropriate, like a boyfriend I had when I was 12 or something like that. And of course, I have no idea where this guy lives now, and so, you know, I'd call, you know, 47 other people to try to track him down. And you know, we're very persistent people. I think we can get just about anything done, and I could usually catch up to him, and gosh, wasn't he pleased to hear from me when I finally did. I'll tell you, if I get nothing else out of Alcoholics Anonymous but being sober and not calling people on the phone and tormenting them anymore, it's really enough. Because in the end, my mother was the one who took all those calls. My mother was the only one who would take the calls. I absolutely tortured her, you know, almost nightly at the end with these terrible, drunken, middle-of-the-night phone calls. I am so grateful that I don't do that anymore. One night I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no idea what triggered the notion to call Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I suppose God had a hand in it, but I had no idea then what triggered the idea to call Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember dialing the number, and a real nice man answered the phone and asked me if I was having a problem with alcohol, and I said that I was, and I started to cry. And he told me a lot about himself, and I remember he wanted to send some women over to my house, which I thought was a terrible idea. If he had offered to come by, I would have been interested, but he didn't. And he said, do you think it was a Friday? He said, do you think you could not drink tomorrow and go to a meeting tomorrow night? And I said, oh, sure. Now, I drink every day. I don't know if I can not drink tomorrow or not. I doubt it. You know, I mean, I doubt that I can not drink. It's a convoluted way of saying that. But I know the right answer. The right answer is clearly, oh, yes, I won't drink tomorrow. And so I said yes. And he told me where a meeting place was near where I was living for the next night. And we hung up. And, of course, I continued to drink until I passed out. And the next morning I came to, and I remember making the phone call, and I remembered little parts of it. And I found the piece of paper where I'd written down the address of the meeting place. Now, the next morning there in the light of day, I thought I'd been a little premature in calling Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember thinking, God, I'm only 30 years old. I'm sure that's too young to be an alcoholic. Which is kind of a funny thing to say today. When I got sober at 30, 23 years ago, that was young to get sober. Not like outrageously young, but I was considered a young person. Today, you're like over the hill at 30. Like, what took you so long to get here? But anyway, I thought it was too young, and I thought I'd really overstepped the mark there. But I couldn't get it out of my mind all day, and I heard myself saying to my husband that night at the dinner table, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. He said something really warm and loving, like, yeah, whatever. And just kind of how we talked to each other then. And he went off to the racetrack, which was his thing, and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I dressed with some care. I remember I changed clothes. You know, I've always wanted to be dressed right for wherever I go, and the problem is I've never been to Alcoholics Anonymous, so I have no idea how that might be. I don't remember what the clothes were that I took off as being inappropriate. I just remember that there was a pile of them on the bed when I left that I had discarded as not being quite right. I'm assuming in the end that I decided to just go for comfort, because what I came to you in that first night was rubber thongs on my feet and baggy jeans and a knit top that all the knit had gone out of, you know, so it just hung there. I had two of these, a red and white striped one and a blue and white striped one, and that's what I wore to meetings for the first, I don't know, a couple of months, I guess, and nobody ever said anything about how I was dressed until one night I was a couple months sober, and I had been somewhere earlier in the day, and I was running late, and I didn't have time to go home and change into my meeting clothes, and so I came to the meeting dressed in what I was dressed in that day, which was a nice wool pantsuit in a really soft sort of a rose color, and I think every single one of the 200 people in that meeting that night individually told me how pretty I looked. And you know, it made me feel good. It really did. And I started dressing a little better for meetings after that. But to go back to this first meeting, I'm in these terrible clothes. I didn't drink that day. The guy on the phone said, don't drink, so I didn't drink. Now, it was an 8:30 meeting. Often by 8:30, I'm already passed out. And so I wasn't feeling very well at 8:30 that particular night. I needed a drink just in the worst way. And I was sick and shaking, and I was sweating buckets, which was this sort of side effect of drinking that I had, and in these terrible clothes. And I came to the meeting, and I came in the door, and I was standing in the back of the room. I got there, 2 minutes before the meeting was going to start, because God forbid I might actually have to speak to somebody. And I'm standing in the back of the room just sweating and shaking, and a man came up and asked me if I was new. And I thought, how did he know that? You know? And I allowed us how I was new, and boy, it seemed like that. There's about 50 women coming at me, and they're all scribbling their numbers on little scraps of paper, and teeth. I remember lots of teeth, you know. You know what else I remember? This is absolutely totally meaningless, but it's just a personal thing. Nobody then had business cards. Today, everybody has a business card. Nobody did. They were all ripping off like the back thing of it from their checkbook deposit slips or writing it on the backs of, scraps of paper. Somehow it seemed more personal to me, but that's just a personal thought. Today we have, and we do this in my home group, so I'm not criticizing other people's home groups, we have these lists of, if you're a newcomer woman, we give you a list of with phone numbers of sober women with their sobriety dates and their phone numbers, and that all seems great, but you take away, I think, one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, and that is this. My sponsor told me when I was new that I had to call her every day, and that every meeting I went to, I had to ask three women for their phone numbers that I didn't already have, and then the next day I had to call those three women. I never would have called anybody off a list, I can tell you that. I had a hard enough time calling women that I'd actually met the night before. I always thought they weren't going to know who I was, I might have, in retrospect, said, hi, I'm the one who cried through the meeting last night, and I'm sure they would have remembered because I cried all the time. But I didn't, and I was really nervous about calling these people. I didn't see any point to calling all these people. I just didn't get it, how's calling a stranger going to keep me sober? But I did it because I knew my sponsor would quit talking to me if I didn't, which is the reason I did most of the things that she told me to do. I just wanted her to like me and not fire me. That's all. And so I did it, and I'd sit by the phone, and I'd be sweating, thinking about calling you, and you'd answer the phone, and I'd, in one giant breath, I would say, hi, my name is Pat, I have long brown hair and glasses, and my sponsor told me I had to call three people every day, and you're one of them for today, so how are you anyway? Now, I don't even know if they heard or understood what I said, but they seemed to understand that I was new, And they all said kind things or, oh, hi, how you doing? We never had any deep, meaningful conversations that I can recall, but we had little chit-chatter. They might say something funny. The good ones, would say something funny that would make me laugh, and then sort of, then we'd hang up, and then I'd sort of gear up for the next call. And, I did that for a long time, and I never saw the point, never, until I was about 3 years sober, and my husband was in the hospital dying of cancer, and he had been sick for a long time, and like a year, I guess, by then. And I was at the hospital one particularly bad day, and I thought, I can't do this anymore. I wasn't thinking of going out and having a drink, but I don't know what I was thinking. I just knew I couldn't put one foot in front of the other one more second. And the thought occurred to me, it would probably be a good idea to call my sponsor here. And so I stepped into the phone booth at that hospital, and I called my sponsor, who wasn't home. This was before anybody had, I don't think voicemail had even been invented yet. Nobody I knew had answer machines. I mean, it was just, it rang and rang and rang, and eventually I hung up, and the dime came back. And without even thinking, I just reached in my purse and I pulled out my book that I carry and I, you know, looked up somebody else's number and I called them. And the long and short of the story is I called 11 people that day before somebody answered their phone, before somebody was home. And never once did it occur to me to step out of that phone booth and say, oh, screw it. I just kept dialing until I found somebody. That's why she had me calling 3 people every day. So when the day came when I absolutely, positively needed to speak to another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, the habit of making those calls would be so deeply ingrained in me that I would do it on automatic pilot. That's why she had me doing that. I didn't know that, you know. Every direction my sponsor's ever given me has had that. I think of it as the sort of ripple effect. You know, you do something when you're 3 days or 3 months or 3 years sober and you start doing something and you keep doing that. It has this, what I think of as the ripple effect. It doesn't ever seem to have any effect today, the first day I'm doing it or the first week I'm doing it, but somewhere down there is going to be the day that I'm going to need to draw on that particular thing, or that particular thing is going to, I'm going to understand. I remember one of her early directions. Now I had to get, my direction was to get to every meeting an hour early. I was to have early commitments, you know, like cookies or coffee or something that required me to get there early. I was to get there 1 hour early. That doesn't mean 55 minutes early. It means 60 minutes early. I was to get there and I was to do whatever my commitment was. And then I was to wander through the room and shake hands with everybody as they got there and ask them how they were as though I cared. And the good news for me and for you too, if you're anything at all like me, is my attitude, thank God, doesn't matter. What matters is that I take these actions. If I take the actions, my sponsor very seldom would talk to me about how I felt about things because she kept saying to me, it doesn't matter how you feel. If you just do what I'm telling you, you're going to feel differently 10 minutes from now anyway, so just shut up and do it, or loving words to that effect. I'd get to the meeting 60 minutes early, and I'd slam those cookies around in the kitchen, and then I'd come out and, you know, hi, Fred, how are you? And he'd say, fine, how are you? And I'd tell him how I was, you know. And I sort of, into the dramatics of it all, you know, great wrenching sobs, not just little, you know, not little tears, but great, oh, God, Fred, it's so sad, I don't know what I'm going to do, you know, until his eyes would glaze over, and hi, Mary, how are you? And that's what I did for that whole hour. That is what I did. You were very kind to me. You would say things as you fled, like, keep coming back. It gets better day at a time. Now, that is my personal least favorite. I used to think, I'm dying right now, right this very minute. I am dying, and you're giving me some vague day in the future. It's going to get better. It's not good enough. I need something a little more right now. But I kept coming back. I thought, actually, that I had the saddest life of anybody who ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm fighting with my husband every single day about Alcoholics Anonymous. He thought that I was coming here to meet men, which was a real good guess. I was looking forward to meeting some of you. None of the men in AA appeared to be interested in me, which hurt my feelings quite a bit. And it also really annoyed me that he was home accusing me of something that I wasn't doing right at this minute. You know, no matter that it's not my choice, I'm not doing it. You know, I felt so sorry for myself. And as I say, I cried all the time. One night I learned, I was about 3 months sober, I think, and I learned the most important thing I've learned right up to this very second. If you hear nothing else, I hope you hear this, because this, I think, is the most important thing I know about staying sober and comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was at my home group meeting, and I was doing what I just described to you, sniveling around the room to anybody who would listen. And I went up to this guy, Larry, and I used to say an old-timer Larry. He actually had about 8 more months than me, but, you know, at the time, he seemed like an old-timer. And he asked me how I was, so I started to tell him, and he cut me off. He said, I don't want to listen to that garbage, except he used a different word. He said, why don't you go find a newcomer to talk to? Perhaps she'd feel better. And he pointed to a girl in the back of the room. He said, that girl over there in the red dress is at her very first meeting. Why don't you just go over there and say hello to her? I remember standing there thinking that I didn't care if the girl in the red dress lived or died, and that I wished Larry would die and mind his own business while he was about it. Who asked him anyway, you know? But I also thought, if I don't go talk to this girl, Larry's going to tell my sponsor. How long can it take? I'll just dash over and say hello. So with these fine, motivating, you know, thoughts going on in my head, I dash over to say hello to this girl. And the girl who had 12-stepped her said, who I knew, said, oh, Pat, I'm so happy to see you. this is this girl's first meeting, and she had this big fight with her husband about coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been waiting for you because I just knew you were the absolute best person to talk to her. I don't think so. I think I'm maybe the worst person in the room. This is split-second thinking here. I'm thinking this all like at one time. I am the worst person in the room to talk to this girl. I have absolutely nothing to share of any hope on this topic. Life is bad for me. It has always been bad. It is apparently always going to be bad. Anybody, including the newest newcomer in this room, would be better to talk to this girl than me. But at the same time, I thought, I am talking to her. I'm standing in front of her. I have to say something here. And I heard myself say, keep coming back. It gets better a day at a time. I've lied to a newcomer. You know, it's not true. But I will tell you what happened to me that night. I walked away from that girl. I know I did not talk to that girl more than 30 seconds because I wouldn't have. I would have been incapable of talking to her longer than that and certainly disinterested in talking to her longer than that. Like there was a center aisle like this in the room. I turned and I was walking back down that center aisle, and I had a spiritual experience. It's as though God reached down and just sort of tapped me on the head. I just don't know how else to describe this. It sounds sort of mystical, and I'm really not like that, but this is my experience. I literally just stopped dead in my tracks, and I realized that it was the first time in that hour period of time from the time I hit the door until the meeting actually starts that I was at the meeting and I wasn't crying. And the reason I wasn't crying is because for this 30-second period, I thought about somebody else besides myself. It says in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that it's important to work with others. It actually mentions that more than once, which leads one to believe it might be important. I think it's real important. I believe that the 12 steps are absolutely divinely inspired. And I also believe that they're wonderfully, wonderfully entwined one with the next. You know, one leads so perfectly into two, which leads so directly into three, and so on. And I don't think that any one step is more important than the other. And if you leave any one out, you're screwed. That's that half measures avail you nothing. That's what that means. You really have to do them all. I strongly believe this. But I believe that the 12th step, the willingness and the ability to work with others, is the one that keeps me reasonably comfortable in my life no matter what else is going on, enables me to walk through my life with some dignity and some hope even when things are not going, you know, as I would have them go. And of course they don't always go as I would have them go. A few years ago my husband had a heart attack, and I know I'm jumping around here, I'm sorry. You, it's early in the morning and I'm not a morning person. It's not even early, is it? It's early to me. It's a fine line when you're talking at a morning meeting. You have to drink enough coffee so you're awake enough to do this, but not so much that you have to be running to the ladies' room every 5 minutes. Anyway, when my husband had his first heart attack, he was in cardiac intensive care for, I don't know, seemed like a lifetime, a week, I guess, 10 days, something like that, and, which meant, of course, that I was sort of living in cardiac intensive care there. And I would go down the hall periodically to the payphone and call our business and, you know, pick up messages and try to return those phone calls and act as though we were there in the office doing business, and call home and pick up messages. And I'm grateful that I sponsor women and have since I was about 10 years sober. And I would have sponsored women before that, but nobody asked me. So I used to think, God, don't they want what I have? And the answer to that is apparently not. When I got better, they started asking. Anyway, I digress. So I'm at the hospital, and so I sponsor these women, and there were a lot of messages from them. But most of the women I sponsor are sober some period of time, some of them many years, some of them, you know, at least a few years. And all of their messages were of the – and because I travel some, they all have somebody else that they talk to when I am not in town or available. So their messages were all of the variety, hi, thinking about you, you're in our prayers, anything I can do, let me know, I love you. And I did not worry about any of them, but – I had just started sponsoring this girl 3 days earlier who was brand new, and her I was worried about. I had met her 3 days before Vince had his heart attack. She was at my Monday night meeting, and she smelled of alcohol. I was so excited. You know, you never meet people like this in meetings hardly ever anymore. People get to Alcoholics Anonymous through treatment centers and whatnot, which is great. However you get here is great, but it's very exciting to me to meet you know, people who obviously were just drinking a little while ago in a meeting. We were actually kind of fighting over her at my meeting there, and I won. And so now I'm her sponsor. So she's 3 days sober, and Vince and I are now living at the hospital. Her I was worried about. And so I would go down the hall, and I'd call for messages, and there she'd be. And if you're new, I'm not making fun of you or any newcomers. I'm really describing myself as a newcomer. I don't know why newcomers have whiny voices, but they all do. And so I'd call for the messages, and there she'd be. Hi, I know you're going through a really terrible time yourself, but I think I might drink because... It was different each time, you know. Somebody at work was cruel to her, you know, whatever. You know, newcomer stuff. And again, if you're new, I'm not making fun of this. I mean, I lived it all myself. And so I'd think, I have to call her. I can't just leave her hanging out there. So I'd call her back, and I'd talk to her, and I'd give her some simple little direction, you know, of, you know, read this page in the book or, you know, say this prayer. Just some, you know, some simple little thing that she could do and sort of mentally pat her on the back and send her on her way, and we'd hang up, and I'd go back and be in there with Vince, and then a couple hours later I'd come back out and call for messages enough, and yeah, there she'd be again, you know, so I'd call her back and talk her off the rooftop again, so to speak. And so Vince got better, and we're back in meetings, and you know, everything's kind of getting back to normal. And this girl called and left a message on my voicemail saying something like, I'd like to thank you for the help you've given me, but Alcoholics Anonymous is much too hard, and I'm quitting. I thought, you ungrateful so-and-so. After all I did for you, I stood in that hospital corridor while my husband was maybe dying in the next room, worrying about your petty little crap, thinking about you, calling you, tracking you down. I'm working up this steam here. And then it occurred to me that God gave me that girl for the best 35 days he could have picked out of 23 years of sobriety. He picked the 35 days when I most needed a newcomer and gave her to me, just gave her to me. You know, for 5 or 10 minutes, 3 or 4 times a day there, I got to not think about what was going on in that hospital room. I got to think about who I really am. I'm Pat, and I'm an alcoholic, and I am that girl on the other end of the line. I can't stay sober. That stupid stuff at work and all that makes me crazy. It makes me drink. I got to say out loud several times a day to this girl who I really am. I got to remember it for me out loud. What a gift. What an absolute gift for me. You know, I hope that girl gets sober. I know we're not supposed to pronounce other people alcoholics, but she belongs here. I really hope she gets sober again, but whether she does or not, she saved my life, and there's no doubt about it in my mind. That's what sponsoring people and working with other alcoholics does for me. I'm so grateful that I get to sponsor these women. I never, you know, for years I said I didn't sponsor anybody, and I really wanted to sponsor people. All my peers in Alcoholics Anonymous were sponsoring, and I felt slighted, you know, and kind of embarrassed, actually, that I wasn't sponsoring people. And I kind of whined about it a lot, and people would say, just relax, you know. I see that you talk to new people, and you give them your phone numbers, and you have no control over whether they ask you to sponsor them or not. So I started praying that God would send me somebody to sponsor. You got to really be careful what you pray for. He sent me this horrible woman that everybody in my group had sponsored at one time or another. Just this wretched woman. She was so unlikable. And so I sponsored her. And then I realized it wasn't really that I wanted to sponsor you. I mean, I didn't want to really talk to you and take your calls or talk about the steps or anything. I wanted the part where when you got up and took your birthday cake, you thanked me for how wonderful I was and how I had. That's the part that I really was kind of after. Once I kind of realized that, I sort of relaxed about the whole deal, and then before you knew it, I was sponsoring people. And so anyway, to go back to when I was new, my sponsor's given me these terrible directions that seemed to have no bearing on anything at all. I would tell her, you know, what was wrong, and she would give me, it's like I would tell her the problem, A, B, C, and she'd give me the answer, 42, 43, 44. You know what I mean? It was like apples and oranges. I'd say, were you listening? And she'd say, just do it. I remember one time I called her up, and she had been in my house, so she knew how I lived. Called her up one time and I was crying hysterically. I cannot remember now what it was, but it was awfully important at the time. And she interrupted me and she said, I want you, it was like an hour before I was supposed to leave for the meeting, and she interrupted my harangue and she said, I want you to hang up this phone and take everything off of you. I had this great big glass covered coffee table. So I want you to take everything off that coffee table and get out the Windex bottle and spray that table down and polish it up real nice and wipe out all the ashtrays of the dirty cigarette butts, you know, and throw away the 7-week-old newspapers and stack up the magazines that you're planning to keep neatly and come to the meeting and I'll talk to you there. And she hung up. I've just told my sponsor that my life is completely falling apart and she has told me to Windex the coffee table. Clearly, she does not understand what she's doing here, as near as I can tell. But I Windexed the coffee table because I knew if I got to the meeting and said that I hadn't done it, that she wouldn't talk to me. So I Windexed the coffee table and I did exactly what she said. You know, as I left for the meeting that night, as I was pulling that door closed behind me, I glanced back at that coffee, and it really looked nice. It kind of made me feel good, you know. In fact, it made me feel so good when I got home. I did the end tables, too, you know. And I heard a guy say early on when I was new that somebody told him to go home and put clean sheets on his bed and make his bed. And again, it doesn't seem to have much to do with anything, but it has everything to do with it. You know, that is a rule that I keep for myself today. I make my bed every single day. For years, we lived in a two-story house, and our bedroom was upstairs, and I would sort of play with the idea of, well, even if we had company, they'd never see that bed because, you know, company doesn't go upstairs. And so I really don't, if I was in a hurry, you know, or had overslept or something, I don't really have to make that bed. And I can tell you that my day went differently. There's something about that unmade bed that just follows me around all day. I need to have my life in order. And whether that's Windexing the coffee table or making that bed, anything that helps me start out my day better is better for me. The way I start my day is I get out of bed and I get on my knees and I say a prayer, and then I get up and I make the bed, unless, of course, my husband is still in it. And then he's asked if I wouldn't mind waiting until he's up to do that. My sponsor told me when I was new, I was about 3 or 4 months sober, and she said, I told you, you know, I'm getting all these meetings an hour early. My husband is saying, why do you have to get there so early? I don't understand that. And I would say, well, I'm the coffee maker. And he would say, well, why don't they get single people to do that sort of thing? And I had no answer for that because that was my thought. Why indeed don't they get single people to do that? Why are you making a married woman? You know, it really seemed unfair. And so I'm having all this trouble, you know, and fighting with him all the time. And now, like it's not bad enough, my sponsor gets this idea that on every Thursday I'm to pick up these two old ladies and bring them along to the meeting too, Claire and Zelda. Claire and Zelda, you can bet your bottom dollar, didn't live anywhere close to me or on the way. So now I cannot cut into that 60 minutes to go pick them up. I have to leave this much earlier so I can go pick them up and still get there 60 minutes early. To say that I was resentful would really be to understate the case here. I did not like Claire and Zelda to begin with. And I really resented that I now got to go out. Every Thursday, just about, I'd call my sponsor from work and I'd say something like, God, we're really busy at work here. It looks like I might have to work a little late. And she'd say, well, you better eat a sandwich at your desk then. You can't be late picking up Claire and Zelda. And so I'd go get them and I'd get them in the car. And the truth of the matter is they scared me. They were really old. And they both smoked and they had emphysema, and so they had those terrible coughs that people who smoke who have emphysema have, you know. And I was actually, the truth of the matter is, I was afraid somebody was going to die in my car. And I'd get them in the car, and I'd be driving, and of course they'd smoke and try to talk at the same time, you know, and they'd sort of be hacking and coughing, and I'm not listening to anything they say, and I'm thinking, as soon as we get there, if somebody's dead, I just go in the meeting, and I get, you know, six guys, and I say, get her out of my car, no problem. But it was on the way home. There's nobody at that end, you know, taking them. So anyway, we'd get to the meeting, and we'd pull up, and we'd get out of the car, and we'd walk in the meeting. I would never speak to them again the entire night until it was time to go home. I wouldn't sit near them. I wouldn't speak to them. I hated them. Have I made this clear how I feel about them? One night, I'd been doing this a few months, and I went to pick them up, and Zelda was sick and didn't go to the meeting, and so Claire and I went. And the next day, I was at work, and I found myself thinking about Zelda and wondering if she was okay, and I actually called her. I couldn't believe it. I hate this woman. What do I care if she's sick? But I called her up to check on her and see if she was okay. And I believe that is the beginning of me learning how to be a friend. You know, I didn't know that that's what was happening to me. I had no idea that's what I was doing. I thought my sponsor was just cruel, and I don't know what I thought. But, you know, I have friends today in Alcoholics Anonymous that I cannot believe the friendships that I have. And I know it began there with Claire and Zelda. That's how I learned to start caring about somebody besides myself. Again, that ripple effect that I was talking about, you know. During my first year of sobriety, it was clear to me that all the problems, the reason I felt this terrible way that I felt, was my husband. It can't be me. I'm working this spiritual program here. So whatever problems are going in my life must be his fault. It seemed very clear to me. With an attitude like that, of course, it was inevitable that one night at a meeting, I would meet a man who looked real, real good to me. This momentous occasion occurred when I was about 10 months sober. The gentleman in question was about 10 minutes sober. I spotted him when he came in the room there and leapt across some chairs to introduce myself to him. And my sponsor noticed, and I just remember her standing there doing this, you know. So I went over there, you know. And she said something like, "Let us not forget that we're a married woman." She always uses that kind of royal we, you know. And I remember standing there saying, yeah, but I'm so unhappy. She said, nonetheless, you're married. And as long as you're married, I expect you to act married. I said, I don't see this as a problem. I'll get divorced. And she said, no. We don't think it's a good idea to make those kind of major moves in our first year of sobriety. You just stay married and act married. Well, I was obsessed. I know you understand this if you're in this room. I was obsessed. Why would God get this guy sober in my home group if he did not mean for us to be together? This is so clear. What is wrong with her that she can't see this? And so we began that. I think of it now as the death dance. We started this courtship, shall we loosely call it. That's really a stretch. It starts with the meaningful glances across the room and brushing up against each other in the coffee line. And then he's walking me to my car after the meeting, and then I'm parking further and further away from the meeting, It's complicated to arrange these kind of liaisons. I'm a married woman. Obviously, we're not going to go to my place, and he's a newcomer. He doesn't even have a place, but I'm telling you, alcoholics can get stuff done. So I was working at the time at this record company in Hollywood, and this gentleman was also working in Hollywood at a porn bookstore, and kind of a nice newcomer job, don't you think? And I arranged this long lunch artwork one day for somebody to cover for me, and he didn't have a car either, so I went and picked him up at the bookstore, and we went to this motel on Sunset Boulevard and spent some time together, and I drove him back to his bookstore there afterwards, and I was in the car driving back to my office, and it occurred to me that I was 10 months sober, and I was living exactly the way I had always lived. I'd been sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 months, hearing you say night after night after night that I was going to have to change everything about the way I'd been living my life, or I was surely going to drink and die. I don't know what I was thinking during those 10 months. Likely that it didn't exactly apply to me, but I knew that day in the car that it did, and I was scared, because I've never wanted to be this kind of a woman, but wanting doesn't make it so. I didn't see how Alcoholics Anonymous could help me change. I would hear people say that all the answers to all of their problems were in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would go home, literally, and go leaping through that book looking for the answers, and I could never find them. They're there, but I couldn't find them then. I was scared to tell my sponsor what I had done because she'd been so clear in her direction about this. But the bottom line is I don't want to drink, And so you know how we are now. I've done the deed, so I hardly let the poor woman get in the meeting hall that night. I'm knocking her down, saying, I have to talk to you right now. And so I told her what I'd done, and she said, Pat, I think you've learned a really good lesson here today. I don't believe you're a woman who could stay sober if she cheated on her husband, and you don't have to live like that anymore if you don't want to. Okay, I just finished telling you I don't want to. I don't get it. What do I do? Here's what I did. Got to pay real close attention because this goes by really fast. A day at a time, I stayed away from him. Did you get it? That was it. Day at a time, I didn't drive by that bookstore. Day at a time, I didn't call him. Day at a time, I didn't take his calls. A day at a time, when I saw him in meetings, I shook hands with a locked elbow. Does everybody understand what that means? That means you don't get any closer than the length of your arm. I would say, hello, and keep moving. That's what I did. I thought that I should talk to him sort of one final time to explain what was going on here. My sponsor said, no, I don't think so. I think he'll get the idea. Seemed really cruel to me, but I got the idea that half measures weren't going to get me anything, and so I did it 100% her way. Now, the obsession passed, of course. Obsessions always pass, but the really good news for me is I don't live that way anymore, and I didn't know that could happen. I didn't know that I could change to that degree. I simply didn't know it. I'm a member of a huge home group. I belong to the Pacific Group in West Los Angeles. We get about 900 people at our Wednesday night meeting, and I was secretary of that meeting a few years ago, so everybody pretty much knows who I am, and every week I would give the announcements. Now, I know there's people in that room who probably don't like me. I'm not so stupid to think that everybody just adores me, but I know that not one of them would sit there and think, oh, yeah, Pat, she cheats on her husband, because I don't live that way anymore. What a gift, because I always lived that way before, always. I really did get to change here, I like to tell that story for another reason, too. I told you somebody at work covered for me that day so I could go off and do this deed. The person who covered for me, of course, was my friend at work. You know how you have a friend at work who's like the one you hang out with and talk to and tell your stuff to? Well, of course, that's who covered for me, and she knew where I was going and what I was doing that day. In fact, we talked about it after I got back to the office that day, and I stayed on that job a few months after this event, and then I moved on, got a better job, and moved on. But I stayed in touch with that woman. We would get together every once in a while, have lunch, and catch up on news with each other. And about a year after I left that job, I heard through another mutual friend that this lady's husband had developed a drinking problem. And they had joined some church, some kind of far, I'm not putting down far out churches if you belong to one, but I'm just saying, they had joined some sort of unusual church in the hope that his drinking problem would be resolved. And I thought to myself, why would they do that? She knows a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous. We talked a lot about AA. Why wouldn't she go to Al-Anon? Why would she? What she saw of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's a place where people cheat on their spouses. I don't suppose she would have been too keen to send her husband there, you know? It really made me stop and think for the first time in my sobriety that the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous have a little something in there for me to listen to and pay attention to. Up to that point, I'd kind of been sitting there thinking that, yeah, that applies to the group or AA as a whole, or I kind of heard it but didn't hear it. I could have recited them, but I didn't really know what they meant. It says in there that this is a program of attraction. That's very clear. It's a program of attraction. I did not make it an attractive place for that family to go. I cannot tell you how strongly I feel about this subject. If we're going to let people out there know that we're sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, we really do have an obligation to make it a place where they might want to come or send a loved one or recommend to a friend. And so I'm happy to say that I've had the opportunity to be a better example to other people that I've worked with and so on in subsequent years. But I don't know what ever happened to that family. I hope they're okay. When I was a year and a half sober, my time is running out here. When I was a year and a half sober, my first sponsor drank. And I got another sponsor right away, and this woman was sober a long time, and I wanted what she had. And she said, I've watched you whine and snivel about this marriage from the day you walked in. I want you a day at a time to act as though you're a kind and loving wife to this guy. It was not an appealing idea. I didn't love him. I wasn't interested in loving him. He wasn't all too fond of me either, I might add. And she said, I didn't see the point. I really didn't. I thought I should get out of this marriage, this is how I thought, while I'm still young and have my looks. And she said, I recommend that you stay there. And so I did. I didn't want to, and I didn't do this stuff graciously or happily, but I did it. And she gave me real simple directions, like every day when I went home from work, I was to ask him how his day was and then listen when he told me. And I really don't have time to tell all this stuff. But, you know, a day at a time I did this stuff. And some days I was better at it than others, you know, but I did the best I could. And time went by, and months, close to a year maybe, and I was on my knees one night saying my prayers, which up to that point were very, very short. In the morning I would get on my knees and say, Dear God, please help me stay sober today. Amen. And at night I would get on my knees and say, Dear God, thank you for keeping me sober today. Amen. I did that because I was told to do it. I believe in God. I've always believed in God. But I felt, up till that time, I had felt no connection whatsoever on any occasion when I said those prayers. They just were words into the room, and I just did it because I knew that if I missed that would be the day my sponsor would say, Did you say that prayer today? So I just did it. And I was on my knees this one night saying that prayer. Dear God, thank you for keeping me sober today. Amen. And I started to get up. And I realized that I was comfortable in that house with that husband. And it hadn't happened that day. It had already happened sometime before. And I didn't even know. It's the biggest problem in my life. And I didn't even notice when it went away. You know, I realized that I was really comfortable there. And I remember I got back down on my knees and I said, God, I believe if you mean for me to stay married to this man that I could do that and stay sober and have a happy life. Thank you. It was not long after that we found out that he had cancer. And as I think I talked about it earlier, he was sick for about a year and a half and he did die. And, you know, it was a hard year and a half, but it was the best year and a half of our marriage because of what you taught me. You know, I went down to the chapel the day of his funeral, and it was a weekday, and a couple hundred people from Alcoholics Anonymous took off from work and came that day because they knew, they didn't know him, but they knew that I would need them that day, which of course I did. And I realized sitting in that chapel that day that what my sponsor had promised had happened. She had promised me that if I did this stuff, I could make amends for some of that stuff that I had done, you know, and I had. I felt obviously sad about his death, but I felt clean and whole and right about my part in our relationship. I knew that I had made my amends to him a day at a time by initially just by acting like a kind and loving wife until, in fact, I became a kind and loving wife. It's such a It was such a blessing to me to sit there that day and realize how wrong my thinking is. You know, if I'd done it my way, I would have missed that completely and totally. And not only would I have missed that, but I would have missed the relationship that Vince and I have today. You know, I know from my half of this relationship, it wouldn't be possible if I hadn't learned the tools there with my late husband. You know, again, that ripple effect. You know, you just have no idea what the directions you're getting or how they're going to affect you down the road. I feel like I've sort of just jumped all over the place here today, and I'm sorry for that. You get what you get in the morning with me. I can tell you this. My life is better than it's ever been, and that's not to say that there aren't sort of significant problems going on. There are some, and yet I'm really okay. You know, I sort of think it's a bit of an adventure. I have no idea what God has in store for us. I wish He'd hurry up and tell us. Seems like we've been waiting long enough here, but, you know, in His good time, I know that if I can just stay out of the way, it's going to be better than the way I would try to manage it and put it together. I always have, like, these great ideas, but I just need to do the next indicated thing, as my sponsor told me when I was very new. You know, it's important to keep doing this stuff. I told you my first sponsor drank, and she got sober again shortly thereafter, and I think she had about 20 years most recently, and she drank again. My second sponsor drank last year, and she had 31 years of sobriety. Nobody in this room is immune, you know. It's a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of your spiritual condition, and I feel real bad about those former sponsors drinking, but I'll tell you, what it does for me is it makes me really look at what I'm doing. You know, it really makes me tighten up any loose ends I've got going on. If you're new in this room today, I would recommend that you do three things that I think are about of equal importance. One is get a sponsor. Ask somebody to sponsor you who's active in Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody who can help guide you through this deal. The second thing I recommend you do is get a home group, a place where you are the cookie maker, the cookie bringer, you can make them if you want to, I don't care, but you know what I'm saying, a little job that you do that requires you to be at that meeting to show up to do it, you know. And the third thing I recommend you do is make a friend, somebody around your own length of sobriety you can hang out with and talk to. And, you know, when you're new, it's nice to hear how stuff's going to sound before you call your sponsor with it. Sometimes you want to fine-tune the wording just a little bit, you know. I'd call my friend Betty and say, okay, here's what I'm thinking of doing, or worse, here's what I've just done. And hoping that Betty would say, oh, yeah, sounds good. Sometimes she said that, but mostly she would say stuff like, oh, man, you better call your sponsor right now. And that's a really good kind of friend to have. If you're new, I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope you stay. Thank you.